Josh Weil was awarded the Sue Kaufman Prize for First Fiction for his novella collection, The New Valley, published in 2009. He is also the recipient of a 5 Under 35 Award from the National Book Foundation. Today, we're talking to Josh about his debut novel, The Great Glass Sea, published by Grove Press. Josh, you've gone from short stories and novellas to this expansive, nearly 500-page novel, and it's not a quick read. Your writing style, in fact, and I mean this in a great way, the sentences are so rich, so lush, that I found when I was reading it, I almost wanted to read every sentence twice and just to linger over it. So, folks, when you pick this book up, this is more than a beach read. This is where you go unplug in the woods and just immerse yourself. So tell us about this book a little bit. What's its storyline?
I think of it really as a fraternal love story. It's about two brothers who are very close. Their father dies when they're very young, suddenly, and their mother becomes unable to care for them. And so they are each other's rocks in a suddenly very unsettled world. And they become the most important people in each other's lives. And then adult life intrudes and huge changes include the collapse of the Soviet Union and the shift that Russia took into capitalism, because they're Russian characters. This all takes place in Russia. And the pressures of contemporary life that I think most Americans can also understand intrude. And the story becomes about the way that the two of them are desperate to hold on to the love that they had as kids, as the pressures of adult life break them apart.
You've spent real time, I understand, in the Soviet Union and in Russia, which isn't the same thing. And I understand that you've learned the language. Where did your interest in this area and the culture begin?
From a few different things, actually. Probably first, in the very beginning of my interest, my mother's side of the family was all Russian. They came over to America a few generations ago. But I grew up eating some foods that were reminiscent of that country and their life there. And my mom would put on records on the record player of folk music, and we'd dance when I was a little kid. So there was always some of that in me. And then when I was in sixth grade, I had a crush on a girl. Mm. And she decided that she was going to take Russian language when she went to junior high school in seventh grade. And so, of course, I took Russian language so I could be in the same classroom with her.
Of course.
And that set me down this path that became the most important part of my high school experience and junior high experience, 6 years of Russian language study. This was at just a public school, but it was a very good public school. And I had a terrific Russian teacher and the same teacher for all 6 years, and also moved up through the kind of ranks with all the same students. So it was really the most central aspect of my life at that time, when I was just starting to figure out who I was as becoming a young man. So that was kind of very, very important to me and one of my ways into Russia. And then when I was 14, I went to the Soviet Union, the last year that it was the Soviet Union, 1991, just about, I think, 6 or 7 months before it collapsed. And I was on a student exchange group and lived with a host family in a country, in a city to the far north of the country, near Finland, in the Karelian region, a city called Petrozavodsk. And that's the city upon which the city in my novel is based. And so living with just a working-class family for a while, seeing such a hugely different way of life, this, like I say, was still the Soviet Union, opened up such a different world to me and affected me in ways that I knew would be with me for a long time. And then when I started to take writing seriously, I always knew that I would want to write about Russia, but didn't really have a way in, didn't have a movement into that, a path, until I started on this story. So it all kind of came together in around 2009 when I wrote the first draft of this, for various reasons that have to do with the space mirrors that are part of this book, which is something I hadn't mentioned yet, but there's a whole other aspect of this.
Any thoughts of translating it into Russian?
You know, I mean, I certainly wouldn't be able to do it myself. My Russian language skills plummeted after I stopped studying, as anyone who's taken a foreign language knows, if you don't use it, you lose it, certainly. And although I went back in 2010 to do research and so studied again, I was only able to get to a point where I could converse a little bit and make my way around the country. There hasn't been interest yet about translating it into Russian, but if someone wanted to do that, I think it would be pretty cool.
Yeah. Now, there are elements of real history in the novel and elements of fable as well, as something futuristic, although I wouldn't call it science fiction. Talk about this blend.
Yeah, it was quite a thing to try to get my hands around. And I think that if I had known that I was embarking upon such a complex and big project, I might have been too scared to do it. But you mentioned the shift that I took from short stories and novellas into this novel. And one of the aspects of that was that I started writing this thinking it was a short story. I have a story collection that I'm working on called The Age of Perpetual Light that's linked to this novel. And the novel, I thought, was just going to be one of the stories in that collection. And I wrote the first scene, and it was about 12 pages long or so. And I realized very quickly, either this is not the story that I thought I was writing, or it's not a short story. Mm-hmm. And so kind of it snuck up on me. Then I thought it was a novella, and it turned into being a novel. And like I say, I might have been scared by all of these disparate and complex elements if I thought that I was going to be embarking on that for the next 5 years. As it was, by the time I got the first draft done, I was in it, and I was committed to the characters. I cared about them. I loved the characters. I didn't want to lose this story, so it kind of had its hooks in me. And that meant I had to deal with all these things that you talked about. There are elements of fable in here. A lot of the book springs from Russian folklore, from old Rus tales, everything from, there's a beast called the Chudo-Yudo, which makes an appearance in this, and there's a tale about the Chudo-Yudo leaping up out of the water and into the sky and swallowing the sun. And Ivan Popeliev, who is the hero of many Russian fables, often called Ivan the Fool, has to go out and kill the Chudo-Yudo and to bring light back. And things like that fed into and just spoke to other aspects of the book that tie into the kind of futuristic stuff, the slightly sci-fi stuff that you mentioned, although I also don't think of it as science fiction at all. But I think of it more as magic realism. And the elements that could be thought of as science fiction in this, the main one is that there are these satellites called Zerkalo, which just means mirrors in Russian, that are sent up into orbit and carom the sun down into the dark part of the Earth. In this case, this experiment where it's done on one city, one region, that rids that entire world of the city of nighttime, so there's no darkness, and that's the world in which the novel takes place. And so that has a slight sci-fi element, but I think of it almost as a mythic beast in a fable, these kinds of mirrors, and the way they work upon the story.
Now, along with politics and socioeconomic systems, you delve also into ecosystems. You have to when you construct this kind of a world. What kind of research went into this? And I'm wondering how close to reality or potentially possible in reality is this world that you constructed?
Well, I think there are kind of two elements of it. So the scientific research element of it, I think, is actually pretty close. The Russians actually did send up a satellite in 1993. They called it Znamya, which means banner, and it was meant to reflect sunlight down eventually onto a city with the idea of lighting the city 24/7, and it was successful. It deployed its wings. They were made of Kevlar, reflective Kevlar, and sent down a beam that was 2 or 3 miles wide and a couple times brighter than a full moon, and it swept the globe twice, and then they purposely crashed it into the atmosphere so it would burn up. And then they attempted it again in 1998, I believe it was, and that time its wings didn't deploy, and then they kind of dropped the project. But I wanted to imagine what would happen if they hadn't, and if they'd gone forward with that. So that's the springboard for this, and I think it's tied to real events. And then it was very important to me that I understood the physics well enough how the satellites would work, how they would keep, you know, how a spot of light would be kept in one place, and how they might pick up the job after each other as they swept around the globe. So I talked with physicists about this. I talked with people who would know about satellites and spacecraft, and a lot of it was, you know, as a writer, you're very lucky that there are people out there who know a lot and are generous with their knowledge. Some of it, I would read the books, but the most useful stuff was I'd call somebody up. So when I needed to know, okay, I wanted to be very sure that what I thought would happen to plant life was actually based in fact, what I thought would happen to animal life, and if I was dealing with disruptions of photoperiodic rhythms, of circadian rhythms, of when plants would sprout, when they would bud, which plants would sprout, which plants would bud. But I wanted to be accurate about all that. So I would call up a professor who, you know, if I was a visiting writer at a university, I'd look up who might know about this in the biology department. I'd call him up, and we sat down and had coffee. And it's amazing how generous they were with that, with their knowledge.
Can you describe how the two twin brothers, Dima and Yarik, am I pronouncing
Dima.
That correct? Dima?
Yeah.
Incorporate communism, capitalism, sometimes a blend of both?
Yeah. there's a lot of swirling around in this book, and that is definitely one of the things. Is I was very interested in the way that Soviet Union and then it shifting into Russia had gone through such a dramatic change and so quickly, and the people I talked to there were so caught up in memories of what they call the past life before the Soviet Union fell, and trying to grapple with the system that they were now in, and the way that because it was so extreme allowed me to kind of look with a more focused lens on issues that I think are in any capitalistic society, and certainly in America, with a little bit more of a crystallized questioning than I might have writing about America. So that was very important to me. And so there are issues there are characters who are there's a group of old communists that are pushing kind of communist ideas. There's a group of anarchists who are just anti-work. They call themselves the leisurists. And then, of course, there's an oligarch who represents the way that capitalism exploded in those early 90s years, and people were making $1 million overnight, and the oligarchs were largely people who had been on the black market and understood the way that capitalism worked and were able to step in when that happened. So there are all of these philosophical ideas and issues that are kind of swirling around the book, but I'm very careful in the novel to undercut most of them. And anyone who thinks that they have a solution or an answer, I'm usually undercutting them in some way. And because I'm not an economist. I don't think I have a solution or answer, but these are issues that were important, I felt, for me to look at, and I felt were important for our society right now to kind of muck around with, get our fingers in them, and one of the ways that fiction can do that is through making them human in the ways that they affect the characters.
Yeah. Now, they're twin brothers, and they're the whole premise that this story is built on, but while they're twins, while they're mirror images of each other, they're also polar opposites, light and dark, and, you know, one is the businessman, one is the poet. And at the core, though, they're deeply bonded. What would be the healthy combination, do you think, that we should aspire to, you know, between these two?
Yeah, certainly I think neither of them has the healthy answer. Although, actually, the character who I feel probably closest to, which is the poet, who also is kind of a bum, and not necessarily living a responsible life, I feel closest to him, but the other character is maybe being a little bit more has a little bit more of a balance, but he just is dealing with the pressures of adult life and having a family and having to work and having to support that family and the time that it takes to do that and the way that takes you away from your relationships, which is something that especially in this internet age, where even our relaxation time, our leisure time, our time away from work has become infiltrated by elements of work. We're in kind of a constant productivity, whether it's just answering emails late at night before we go to bed or looking something up online. I think we can relate to that. I certainly felt like I could. As far as a balance, I think it probably has to be different for everyone depending on what their economic situation is, depending on what they love doing in life. The issues for me really kind of came to light and were things that I wanted to wrestle with for two reasons. One was a personal reason, and that was that my relationship with my brother is very, very important to me. We grew up very, very close. And for a period of time through our early 20s, we were the most important people in each other's lives. And then, you know, he got married, he had a kid. He has a job that he cares about a lot that has him on a schedule with not a lot of vacation time. And I had similar things happen in my life. And those are the natural order of things. That's what happens. But it forces a shift in an understanding of that loving relationship that you have as a kid, mm-hmm. and the way that time becomes a commodity. And that became very something that was very difficult for me to wrestle with. And so I wanted to wrestle with it on the page, because I believe that the best writing comes from something that is a core concern of the writer. So that was the personal reason. But then, you know, I also started to become aware of ways in which American capitalism is working that felt troubling to me. Mm. Things like John Maynard Keynes, the economist, and I think it was in 1928. Predicted that in 100 years, the American worker would be working an average of 15 hours a week, and the greatest problem that we would have would be how we kind of use our leisure time well. Well, that clearly didn't happen. And when I look then at other figures, like the fact that in the early 90s, mid-90s, the America, just when Russia was starting to turn to look towards capitalism as they saw it in America, the American worker at that time was more than twice as productive as the American worker had been 50 years earlier. Yeah. More than twice as productive. So making more than twice as much stuff, and yet also working just in sheer numbers of hours of labor, working almost a month more each year. Yeah. And I started to think about all these things and the collapse of leisure time and what has happened, and that felt like on an intellectual level something that was important enough that it was worth a novel. And that's something I often think about. Again, you mentioned my shift from novellas in my first book into the novel. Mm-hmm. One of the things that makes me feel like a novel is a different beast is that it requires 300, 400, 500 pages to deal with whether it's the emotional content of the story or the intellectual wrestling that's going on. It's something that needs those pages or else the book's in trouble.
Yeah. Yeah, with that American penchant to glorify busyness, do you think we're losing some creativity?
I think creativity
probably needs some daydreaming time.
It certainly needs daydreaming time. It needs learning time from mm-hmm. reading other things, from experiencing other things, from going for walks in the woods. These things are important. And I was talking with a woman just the other day who was talking about how when she went to Prague, she was staying with friends, and the parents, an older generation, had this. They had both been in academia and were professors, and had this, you know, apartment that was full of all kinds of cultural things and plays and great books and art. And their daughter had become an extremely wealthy businesswoman and had no time for any of those things, and was all about essentially consumption in the new Czech Republic. Mm-hmm. And the parents spent all their time out at the garden in their dacha, it was a very different focus on life. And I think that kind of encapsulates a big part of the shift that happened in that part of the world. Not that under communism there weren't all kinds of desperate concerns, of course there were, but there was also a place where there was an encouragement for a kind of a life that included a cultural enrichment as a necessity, as something that everybody, including working class laborers, ought to be doing and needed to have a full life. In fact, when I was doing research into the way that the socialists and communists thought about leisure, there was a whole movement to try to work in the Soviet Union to work towards cutting down the amount of labor in a laborer's life, the hours of work in a week, by 1 hour each week, as you know, over a kind of a plan. Of course, they had a plan over a number of years to try to bring that down, with the express purpose of giving people time in order to enrich themselves in other ways. But that was valued, and I think that we don't have we lose sight of that sometimes in this country.
Yeah. Adding to that quality of fable that we've talked about, that the old European folk tales, are the illustrations at the beginnings of the chapters. Now, personally, I could really relate to that. I've come from a Latvian heritage, and when I read those old folk tales growing up, those illustrations really made me nostalgic. Was that something that you did with intention?
Oh, absolutely. I'm so glad to hear that it made you nostalgic for that, because for me, the illustrations, I should say, first of all, are inspired by the work of Ivan Bilibin. Who was an illustrator, an amazing artist, who illustrated a lot of Russian fables and folklore about 100 years ago. And for me, my experience with folktales, Russian folktales, was inseparable from his illustrations. And so I wanted to try to give the reader a similar experience with this book of immediately being placed in a sensibility that felt like it was coming from fables and from folklore, from that part of the world. So although each illustration is drawn from the chapter, and they're obviously my own work, and they're not nearly as skillfully done as Bilibin's, I hope kind of imbue the book with that kind of feeling.
Mm. You're touring together with friend and author Mike Harvke. Any comparisons you'd like to make between your two books? They at first glance, they seem very different, but in talking with both of you, I do see some commonalities coming through in time, but I wondered what you thought about that.
Yeah, at first, I mean, the idea to tour together, at first we just thought, boy, that would be a lot of fun because we're good buds. But then we thought, well, we can't just do it because we're good buds. And so we were really happy just to realize that, as often happens with friends, when we've been friends now for a dozen years, your concerns, as you talk with each other, sometimes influence each other. So although the books seem, like you said, very different on their face, I think that at heart, some of the things they wrestle with are quite similar. And mm-hmm. He's dealing with the American dream. I'm dealing with a similar and kind of the collapse of the American dream in America's heartland. And I'm dealing with a similar idea just in Russia and the way that Russia has adopted American capitalism. And I think both of our protagonists also feel kind of cut off and set outside of their culture and the mainstream culture that they live in. And feel a little bit isolated from that, and wind up taking extreme routes as a way of holding on to themselves and who they are. His gets shifted towards a very dark place, and mine gets shifted towards, I think, a sad place. And obviously, they're different settings, but I think that core concern is there.
Yeah. Josh, I'd love to hear you read a paragraph or so from your book.
Sure. Love to. Let's see. I'll read maybe two paragraphs that are about the effect of the mirrors when they first come to the city. That was how it was after Perestroika. That was how it was until the mirrors came, until the oligarch proposed to make an experiment of the city, the first place on earth illumined by the sun for every hour of every day of all the seasons of the year. He would take the most depressed, torpid town in Russia and grow its productivity as if beneath a heat lamp, sprout a work rate unparalleled in the world. It would be a hothouse of output, a field of ceaseless yield. No long months of winter brooding, darkness drawn over Petropavlovsk like goose down. No twilight melancholy, no dreaminess of dusk. midnight urge to lie on dewy grass between the trolley lines, inhaling summer's scent. No evening ushered crime spike. No street lamps. No car headlights. No night. The first Zircalo Cosmosa lit only the center of the city. It painted gleam on the bronze pates of scowling heroes, flared pilfered sunlight off the memorial cannons and stacks of iron shot. The people of Petroplavilsk gathered at the light circumference, their backs bathed in blackness, their faces aglow. Some crept to the edge, their hands held as if to dip their fingers in the light, faint shadows blooming beneath their bodies, their edges sharpening to noon-like, until they found themselves bathed whole in the caromed sun. In those first nights of that first mirror, the city's heart thumped to the sounds of celebrations. Parents brought their children. Sons carried in their dying mothers. No one slept. They would lie in bed looking through their windows at the glow or shut their curtains and lie there thinking of it.
Thank you, Josh. That was wonderful. And Josh Weil and Mike Harfke will be reading at BookPug on August 21st at 7 p.m. Look forward to seeing you there. Thank you, Josh.
Thank you so much.